Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everybody. It's Matt. How are you?
Hey, Matt. What? How you doing?
Doing well. Doing well. I see from the switchboard, in addition to myself, I have three other people on the line. Just want to do a quick roll call before we kick things off.
Hey, Jeremy's here.
All right. We got Jeremy.
Matt Wright's on.
Excellent.
David Lenhoff.
David's okay, great. So I think we're waiting for Ralph to jump
yeah.
on.
He's actually next door, so I can just make sure he's got the right dial-in number. Hold on one second, let me just peek around.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Now, what's this about?
Yeah.
Be right back. Hold on.
Oh, that's too funny. I love it. And I know that Emily from Altus is probably going to dial in and listen in as well. So we might have some other people just listening in. But I think we should be in pretty good shape. It sounds like the system's working well. I can hear everybody clearly. And then when Ralph comes on, I'll just reconfirm roles because I know he's the ultimate moderator, but I was going to do a brief little introduction. But I don't want to step on his toes too much in terms of the introduction.
Okay.
Okay, guys, Ralph will be on momentarily. Just had to deal with one quick thing.
Sounds good.
Okay, Ralph. Ralph's been kind of a prima donna here, isn't he?
Well, I know he was going to dial in 1 minute, and that was a minute and a half ago, so he should be on in a second.
Didn't he That's ask funny. For a bowl of M&Ms with all the green ones removed?
Well, it's funny. You know, he is the moderator, so that is much like being the lead singer in the band, so he's allowed to do that.
So I remember correctly. So Dave, obviously you're taking the lead in segment one, but Jeremy will be pitching in as well. Oh, I got Ralph here.
I called twice, and I can hear you guys talking, but I can't. You can't hear me.
Huh?
Oh. You know what? That's my fault. Hold on. Let me unmute you. Sorry about that, Ralph.
Are you?
David takes back everything mean. Every mean thing he said.
I know. We're taking all those.
Yeah, that wasn't me.
Yeah, that was Matt. Way to go, Matt.
Don't count that.
Yeah, I know, right. I wish I could blame it on the technology, but I can't. It was human error on my part. So.
Can you hear me now?
I think we're all in.
Okay, terrific. I apologize
Perfect.
For being late. I've been out of town for a week, and my clock on my desk died, and I didn't realize it.
Well,
it was telling
no,
me, it's
no
still
worries.
Telling me it's 5 till 9.
I think we're all good, Ralph. This is Matt Langan here with Altus Marketing. So I wanted to confirm one quick thing here. So I'm going to do a very brief intro for each podcast and do a quick ending. So I'm going to say something along the lines like, welcome to the Altus State and Local Tax Advisory podcast series. Today we're hosting part one of a very special three-part podcast series with Aaron Fox and Altus Group about hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. Right now I'm going to hand it over to our moderator, Ralph Taylor, who is a partner with Aaron Fox. And take it away, Ralph. Something like that, does that work? And I didn't want to step on your toes too much.
No, you're not stepping on my toes, but this is not just an Altus Group podcast, I think. I think you need to say something about Aaron Fox is a co-presenter or whatever, because otherwise you say you're talking about Altus and then you introduce me as Aaron Fox and they're going to wonder, well, where'd that come from?
Yes. Yep, that's a good point. Here, let me just refine that real quick.
I'm going to put you on the speaker for 1 second.
Okay. Yeah,
all right.
Then after that, I'm just going to describe, I'll provide an overview of the three sessions and then introduce the speakers.
Perfect.
And I'll have a similar introduction for each of the other sections, of course, tailored to what it is.
No pun intended.
Right. It's too early. It's way too early.
Okay, I think I'm good. I was just tweaking my little. I always like to have a script in front of me when I do these things. I think I'm good. I'll just kick it off here in about 10 seconds if everybody's okay.
Well, no, I have a question too. I'm sorry. One of the things that I was going to say is when I talk about, I'm going to do a brief description of each of the speakers, a brief bio. But then I'd like to say that their bios and along with those of the other participants are being posted somewhere. And what is that somewhere? What do I call it?
So that's great. We're going to actually be posting this on the Altus State and Local Tax and Advisory blog. And I also believe Aaron Fox, the marketing team on your side, is going to be posting it on your stuff too. So initially where people will hear this will be on the blog itself, and we will link to all of the speaker bios and everything. So you could say something like, and all speaker bios will be available in the blog post that accompanies this interview or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm also going to reference we did a calendar podcast, Matt, 6 months back. I'm going to reference that where it had a printout. I'd like that printout to also be available in the same spot if somebody, like, went in there and there were some documents they could take with them.
Yes.
Can I just say the printout will also be available on the Altus blog?
Perfect. I'll make a note of that, too, just so I don't forget to do that when we write the blog post.
Yeah, and then we'll probably want to link this. We'll probably have something on our own website, too. We haven't talked about how we market this once it gets done, but that's all for another day. But for now, what you've told me will allow me to say what I need to say.
Perfect. Awesome.
And then I just want to make sure for introductory purposes that the first session, David, you're going to be the first speaker, and then Jeremy?
Right.
No, the first session is just David.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the second session will be me, then David, and the third session will be me, then Matt.
Okay, I got to make some tweaks here then. Got to make a lot of tweaks. So then two is going to be David and Jeremy, with Jeremy going first?
Correct.
Okay. And three is going to be Jeremy and Matt, with Jeremy going first.
Right.
Okay. And I presume that if we get into a glitch, we can stop the recording and then pick up again?
That is correct. Yes, we can edit. I mean, ideally what we'd like to do is try to do each interview in or each presentation in one take. Just makes it easier for editing on our side. But by all means, if there's a glitch or something happens, we can stop and it's no problem. It's pretty easy for us.
No, I understand. I prefer to do it in one pass also, but I just want to, you know, just in case, I want to make sure we have the option of stopping and editing. Okay.
Yeah, we do. It's good. All right, we ready to roll?
Yeah.
All right. Good deal. I will kick this off in about 5 seconds here. Welcome to a unique co-podcast with Altus State and Local Tax and Advisory and the law firm of Arendt Fox. Today you'll hear part one of a special three-part interview series with both Arendt Fox and Altus Group about hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. Right now I'm going to hand it over to our moderator, Ralph Taylor, who's a partner with Arendt Fox. And Ralph, take it away.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to part one of our three-part webinar on what you need to know about hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. My name is Ralph Taylor, as we said, and I am a partner in the D.C. law firm of Arendt Fox, and I will be the moderator of all three sessions. This first session, will include an introduction to the tax valuation of real property in general, followed by a more specific discussion of hotel valuations and why such valuations are different from valuations of other properties. In our second part, our speakers will discuss more specifically how DC assesses the value of hotels and identifies issues that may unduly increase your assessment and the tax bill based on it. Finally, in session three, our speakers will describe how you can appeal your hotel assessment if you think it is too high, and we'll also discuss the costs and benefits of appealing. For this first session, our speaker is David Linhoff. David is a nationally recognized expert and author on hotel appraisals. He teaches courses on hotel appraisals for the Appraisal Institute, and he frequently provides expert testimony on hotel valuation cases in D.C. and around the country. David, could you please get us started with a general description of how the value of real property is determined?
Sure. Good morning, Ralph. It is important before we start to talk specifically about how you value hotels to begin at the beginning of any appraisal, and that is the first thing an appraiser has to do is define the appraisal problem. In other words, identify what question he or she is being asked to answer. And in order to do that, the appraiser needs to identify what are termed the assignment elements. And these include identifying the client, identifying any other intended users of the appraisal, identifying the intended use of the appraisal, and then identify the type of value that's being sought, and the definition of that value. And that might seem sort of an odd question to have to answer, but there are certain jurisdictions where market value is not what is being sought. In Arizona, for instance, or in Indiana, you would be estimating market value in use. But in the District of Columbia, it is market value, but you have to define it. There are several definitions of it, and you have to be clear what it is that you're going to be answering. Next, the effective date of the opinion, and finally, and probably particularly important in hotel valuation, is identify the subject of the assignment and its relevant characteristics, and that involves more than just concluding that I'm valuing a hotel at 1000 Connecticut Avenue. It involves identifying the relevant characteristics of the real estate, but also what rights are being appraised and what asset is being appraised. With respect to rights, you would have to identify whether you're estimating the fee simple or the leased fee or some other determined bundle of rights. And then what asset? And with hotels, this is really the root of many of the problems that are encountered in bad appraisals, and that is, are you estimating the value of just the real property, or are you estimating the value of some other bundled assets? in the District of Columbia, you should be estimating just the value of the real property. So once you identify the problem, once it's clear in your mind what it is that you're going to be answering, usually the value is fairly straightforward. With real property, the appraiser capitalizes the rent for the real property, estimates a depreciated cost of the improvements and adds the site value, or makes a direct comparison to sales of similar real property. These are the three traditional approaches to value identified in nearly every real property appraisal text or course. Now, sometimes, though, the appraiser is not able to directly value the real property because you can't get real property rent or real property sales prices easily. And in these situations, the valuation of just the real property can get messy. Hotels are a great example of a situation where this is a particular problem, and that is because the real property component of a hotel is tightly bundled with other assets, such as tangible and intangible personal property and monetary assets. So with an office or a warehouse, for instance, where you would, in an income approach, identify the rent for the real property, the cost to occupy the space, and capitalize it, or find sales of other real property and compare them to the subject, you're not able to do that with a hotel, and for various reasons, the methodology changes. For instance, a hotel's real property isn't offered for rent. I mean, you probably have never driven down a street and seen a sign in front of a hotel that says for rent. On the other hand, you see them all the time on office buildings or industrial properties. And similarly, you probably have never driven by a hotel and seen a sign for sale, where the hotel building is for sale, unless, of course, it's a distressed situation. On the other hand, you see office buildings for sale all the time. And similarly, because of the changing consumer tastes and preferences for hotels, styles and layouts, et cetera, depreciation in a hotel is often accelerated, and their typical life is often much shorter than it is for, say, an office building or an industrial building. So these are some of the obstacles that you confront when you value the hotel real property. But these obstacles notwithstanding, the income approach is usually the primary approach to value hotel real estate, and it is the income approach that creates some of the significant differences among valuations of hotels. So let's take a little bit of a look at what those issues might be. First of all, because you can't find rents,
David,
of the hotel.
Let me interrupt, if I may. Could you define again for our audience what the income approach is or how it works, and just very, very generally?
Sure. That's a good idea. With traditional real estate or conventional real estate, such as a warehouse, you find how much the space in the warehouse would rent for, and then you identify the expenses associated with that, deduct them, and you have what's called net income, and then you convert that to the value of the real estate, usually by dividing it by a capitalization rate, which is simply the relationship between 1 year's income and value. But with a hotel, because you don't have rents of hotel buildings, you have to begin the income approach with the revenue for the total assets of the business. And in addition to the real estate rent, the total assets of a hotel business include such things as the furniture in the rooms, the equipment, the services at the hotel. For instance, if you have an airport van, or you have concierge service, or you have conferences, or you have food and beverage sales, all of these contribute revenue that isn't real property revenue, but it's revenue to the business. But because there are no rents, you have to begin with the revenue to the total assets of the business. And then you deduct the expenses to the total assets of the business, and you're left with the net income to the total assets of the business. Now, if you capitalized that, you would end up with the value of the total assets of the business, and that would be maybe the right answer, but to the wrong question in a hotel assessment situation, because it's the value of the only the real property component that's being sought. So you begin with the income to the total assets. You get the net income to the total assets after deducting expenses, and you're left with the net income to the total assets from which you must now strip or peel away the income that is attributable to the non-real estate components, and this would be tangible and intangible personal property. So let's look at, and by the way, it is this, the stripping away of the tangible and intangible personal property that represents the root of many of the problems with hotel valuations for assessment purposes. So first of all, how do you remove the income for the tangible personal property, and what is the tangible personal property? In a hotel, this is typically the furniture, fixtures, and equipment. It's the stuff in your room, the televisions, the beds, the dressers, the sheets. All of this is personal property. In the kitchen, you have all the kitchen equipment, and this is all fine, but it's not real property, and so the revenue associated with that has to be removed from the income to the total assets. So how might you do this? Well, let's assume that the cost new of the furniture, fixtures, and equipment in a hotel is $25,000 per room key. And let's assume that it's 50% depreciated. That's $12,500 in value per room key. So if you can identify the appropriate capitalization rate for furniture, fixtures, and equipment, which will be a little bit higher than the capitalization rate for just the real estate because it's considered a little bit more risky, you can multiply that cap rate times the $12,500 value, and you get the income that represents the return on and return of the furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And if you subtract that from the income to the total assets, you'll have remaining the income to the real property and the intangible assets. Now, the next step would be to remove the income to the intangible assets. And this begins with an identification of the intangible assets. What might be an intangible asset in a hotel? And one of the easiest to recognize is a flag or an affiliation or a franchise with one of the major hotel companies, say Marriott. Often a hotel owner will pay Marriott a lot of money to have Marriott flag the hotel, that is, name it Marriott, put a flag on it, and train the hotel personnel to perform in a way that's consistent with Marriott's management requirements. This has a lot of value. Obviously, the only reason a hotel owner would do that is if he expected that by doing it, his room's revenue would increase high enough so that he could pay back Marriott the cost of the flag and still retain some sort of return on what he paid Marriott. And so when you remove a franchise from the equation or an intangible asset, you need, just as with the tangible personal property, to deduct an income amount that represents an annual return on and a return of that asset. And so you have
David, David, I'm sorry to interrupt again. Can you explain very briefly what you mean, the difference between return of and return on?
Sure. I think the easiest way to do that, Ralph, is to think of a loan. When a lender, a bank, lends you $100,000, he gives you $100,000, and let's say his interest rate's 5%. What he expects in return for giving you $100,000 is for you to provide him a return of the loan, and that's give him back the $100,000, and also give him a return on the loan, which is the interest rate. So he gets back what he paid, the $100,000 to you, and interest, which is the return on it. So with a hotel and, say, a franchise, the same thing happens. When you pay Marriott for their flag, you expect that the additional revenue at the hotel is going to give you back what you paid Marriott, the return of the investment, plus give you some sort of return on it, some sort of incentive to do it in the first place. So most of the differences in hotel valuations center on how the tangible and intangible personal property are removed from the income to the total assets. And if you don't do it properly, you end up with a value that includes more than just the real property, and the taxes that the property owner would be paying would be inappropriately high.
Great, thanks.
So that's basically the hotel valuation, or in a general sense, and we're going to look at DC-specific hotel valuation in the second podcast.
Terrific. Thank you very much. The next session will include David again, and he'll be joined by Jeremy Chetlick. We off? Hello?
Hey, Ralph.
Matt,
I think
I put them all asleep.
That was great.
Yep. That was good. Do you want another more of a lead-up, Matt, for the second talking? I know we just said we'll be joined again by David Lenhoff and Jeremy Chetlick. Do we want to do more?
I have a lead-off. I wasn't sure whether David was finished or not, or whether Jeremy was
I'm looking at the timing on it. I thought I was due for about 9:27. I thought that's when I had to stop.
Okay, yeah. I have an introduction for the next session. But I wasn't sure. I was sort of winging it. You can edit out what I said, and you'll do your introduction, and then I'll do Matt. You'll do your introduction, and then I'll do my introduction to part two.
I was thinking more of a. Do we want more of a teaser in the end of one, talking about what's coming up next? It was very brief. We'll be talking. I think you said in part two will be David again, joined by Jeremy Chetlick, and that was it. Do we want to do more of a big rollout for part two, Matt?
Yeah, I think if Ralph said at the end something like, okay, so that gives us an understanding of some of the fundamentals of hotel valuation, but let's look more specific. But in the second podcast, we'll look very specifically at how the valuation of hotels is handled in the District of Columbia, something like that.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and then basically you can introduce me, I think, at that point, or just say I'll be joined again by David along with Jeremy Chetlick, who's a former major property supervisor in D.C., who can provide some inside information on the topic, something like that. And then with your exact same introduction that you had planned.
Okay, well, maybe why don't you go ahead and do that, since you and Jeremy are going to be speaking, maybe you guys go ahead and do that wrap-up. Then we'll stop. Matt will come in and introduce me, and I'll pick up.
If I start talking in one, people are just not going to.
No, well,
they don't know who he is.
David can say that's the description of in general. In the next session, I'll be joined by Jeremy Chetlick, and we'll dig deeper into the assessment process in D.C.
Yeah, I can. You want me to do that?
It sounds like you've got it pretty much prepared, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. I would just, David, slightly introduce saying, instead of saying Jeremy Chetlick, assuming they know who I am, just say who worked in D.C. for, I don't know, who worked in D.C.
for. Why don't you just say my colleague Jeremy Chetlick and I will discuss whatever, or we will discuss, and then I will introduce Jeremy as part of the formal introduction to part two.
Okay. So, okay. Matt, how are we going to do that?
That's great. You know, David, if you just want to, we'll all go quiet for about 2 seconds. You want to record your part, and then after you say that, we'll go quiet for another second so it's easier for editing. And then I'll just kick into the welcome to the co-podcast. I'll do the usual intro and kick it over to Ralph like we did last time.
Good. Okay. Now, Jeremy, what was your title in the city?
Supervisor of major properties. Commercial supervisor of major properties.
I've got that in my introduction if you want, David. You don't need to. All you really need to say, I think, is that in the next session we will discuss. Well, whatever.
Okay. All right. Let me see what the title.
Yeah.
Next one is just. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I don't have the title.
I'm ready.
What I've
you're
have,
ready.
Yeah. Okay.
So go for it, David. You
so
good.
Okay. Yep.
All right.
So those are the issues that are encountered with the valuation of hotel property in general. In the second session, I'm going to be joined by my associate, Jeremy Chitlick, a senior manager at Altus Group. And we are going to discuss District of Columbia hotel valuation methodology issues specifically and in more detail. So look forward to that.
Welcome
okay.
back. That's perfect. Yeah, I'll kick in right now with the intro
okay.
for number two. I thought that was great.
Okay.
Welcome back to the unique co-podcast with Altus State and Local Tax and Advisory and the law firm Arendt Fox. Today you'll hear part two of the three-part series with both Arendt Fox and Altus Group discussing hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. And once again, we're going to hand it over to our moderator, Ralph Taylor, who is a partner with Arendt Fox. And take it away, Ralph.
Thank you, Matt. As Matt said, my name is Ralph Taylor. I'm a partner in the D.C. law firm of Arendt Fox, and I will be moderating all three of these sessions. In part one, David Lenhoff provided an introduction to the tax valuation of real property in general. In today's session, and he also focused on with a specific discussion of hotel valuations and why such valuations are different from valuations of other properties. In today's session, David and Jeremy Chitlick will discuss more specifically how DC assesses the values of hotels and will identify issues that may unduly increase your assessment and the tax bill based on it. Our third section will then describe how you can appeal your hotel assessment if you think it is too high, and we'll also discuss the costs and benefits of appealing. As I said, our speakers today are Dave Lenhoff and Jeremy Chitlick. David, who already gave the first presentation, is a nationally recognized expert and author on hotel appraisals. He teaches courses on hotel appraisals for the Appraisal Institute, and he frequently provides expert testimony on hotel valuation cases in D.C. and around the country. Jeremy Chitlick is a tax consultant who helps taxpayers minimize their real property taxes and mitigate the impact of real property assessments. Jeremy previously worked as the major property supervisor for the District of Columbia government, where he was in charge of commercial assessments of properties valued over $10 million. He also worked in the development of the income approach model that the district's Office of Tax and Revenue uses for commercial valuations. More complete bios of David and Jeremy, along with the other participants in this series, are posted on the Altus blog site. Jeremy, could you please start us off today with a brief discussion of how OTR attempts to value DC hotel properties for real property tax purposes?
Sure. Thanks, Ralph. I guess the best way to start this off is just kind of a recap of a podcast that we did late last year where we talked about the DC tax calendar, because we'll jump into in a few minutes how DC actually values the hotel, but without understanding the calendar, it's very difficult to understand why they do things the way they do. So let's start with today or this year. This year's assessment, they call it tax year 16. It's got a valuation date of January 1st, 2015, and then you get your values as of March 1st, 2015, and you have until April 1st, 2015 to appeal. That doesn't really change. It's been pretty set every year. Your income's not required to the district. Your 2014 income's not required to the district until April 15th of this year as of 2015. So as you can tell, they don't have that 2014 income when they're setting your values.
By income, you mean the income and expense statement?
Correct. So they don't have any access to any income that your property generates when they're setting the value. The only income they'll have as of the first of the year of this year will be the 2013 income. And that's something kind of important to remember when you're thinking
about...
That's
calendar year 2013.
Calendar year 2013 income, right. So did your income go way up? Did it go down? Did it stay flat? What happened with your income between 2013 and 2014? Because if you're going to present an appeal to them, you need to know they're going to get your new updated income. And if your income went up, if it doubled, you might be best to kind of step back. But Matt Wright and I, Matt from Aaron Fox and I, will jump into that kind of in part three of this podcast. But I just wanted you to kind of understand that calendar. Now, as you go through that, the valuation date is 1/1/15. You're paying those taxes in March of 2016 and September of 2016. So you have about a year to kind of get the value right before you're actually paying on that, which is something that DC does well and better than a lot of places. Most places say, here's the value, now pay us, and if you think we're wrong and we agree we're wrong, we'll give you a refund, which is kind of a headache. But if you'd like more information on the tax calendar, that podcast that we did last year, we'll repost that podcast and also the printout that was provided with that on the Altus blog. But so why we're here, the getting into the hotel valuation of D.C., it's changed over the past few years since I left. I left the D.C. government 4 years ago, almost exactly. But the one thing that has stayed consistent over the time is that they rely on the actual income figures from the year that they have. Unless your number is way off, like your food and beverage expense is 500% of revenue, they're going to use the actuals, and they've been pretty consistent with that. Some components are stabilized, and that's the management fee and the incentive management fee, which are stabilized at 3% and 1% respectively. They then take a franchise royalty fee of 4% of room revenue. And from the publications I've seen, that 4% is actually below market. We've kind of had this fight with them. The assessors are often not really willing to change anything that's kind of set in their model. So it's just something to consider. If your franchise fee is 6% or 7% like most flags are, you're only going to get credit for 4%. The main problem with that, and I think David might jump into this a little bit later, the main problem with that is if you could get away with only paying a 4% franchise fee, you would do that. But if you're paying 7%, it's to generate the income that you're getting. So by using the income that you're getting and then saying, well, you're overpaying on your franchise fee, it's just not realistic. So then DC does a pretty good job of addressing the FF&E issues, the furniture and fixtures. The main thing that they do there is, I'm sorry, furniture, fixtures, and equipment is what the actual FF&E stands for. This year they take 2% of total revenue for a replacement reserve. Last year it was 5%, but then they give it right back by giving you 4%, which they call the return of FF&E. This is the first time they've actually had something called return of FF&E in the last 3 years. They had taken it away, giving you a higher reserve, and now they're just giving it back. So in addition, a return of FF&E, they remove the personal property taxes from the income stream. The final income and the capitalization, the final income is then capitalized at what they call a market cap rate. And this is where things get a little weird. DC produces what they call a hotel cap rate study in their pertinent data book. And this study shows national surveys of cap rates, which is the right way to do it. The assessor then adds they put this in this study, and I'll put it on here. I'll read it to you word for word, and this is quoting the pertinent data book. The 35 basis point difference between unadjusted and adjusted rate is the net result of adding the effective tax rate, which is 1.85%, and redacting the unadjusted rate to remove FF&E and BEV, unquote. BEV stands for business enterprise value, and then back to reading this. Of 150 basis points, thereby producing loaded cap rate for real estate only. And there's nothing that discusses where the 150 basis points come from and where that number comes from. What essentially they're saying they're doing is, as David said in part one, your lowest risk is the real estate. Your next highest risk is your FF&E, and your the most risky part of this is the business enterprise value. They're saying, well, we removed the FF&E because we've given you return on and return of, and we removed the business enterprise value because we took out the base management fee and the royalty fee. Also, as David testified, what they're doing in this situation, and I'll let him really jump into this, if you've got a $1,000 bond that you take out a three-year bond, you put $1,000 out, in the end of the day, you're going to get your $1,000 back plus a return. There's no reason for you to do a franchise agreement with somebody if you're only going to get the $1,000 back without any additional return. I'm going to hand it off to David to kind of jump into more details of this, but David, hearing how DC does it and your experience at DC, do they get things right here, or is there really some – is there an issue with the way they're doing things?
Thanks, Jeremy. There's an issue. It's a rather significant issue, and it's an issue that relates to our first podcast, which is by doing it the way they've done it, they end up with a value of, at best, the real property and the intangible assets – And at worst, a wrong answer for the value of the real property and the intangible assets. They are supposed to be taxing just the real property, so they're taxing too much. And I can say it's sort of interesting. I can see what they're trying to do here in terms of methodology, because just recently I gave a seminar at their request to the appeals board in D.C., at which the assessors attended. And what I told them there relates to, well, I'll give you a quote from a textbook in the Appraisal Institute, Real Estate Valuation and Litigation, which was written by Jim Eaton, the chief appraiser at the Department of Justice. And he says the following. An appraiser must either extract the net income attributable to the business from the hotel total net income, so the residual net income attributable to the real estate can be capitalized into an indication of value, or develop a capitalization rate high enough to reflect the value of the real estate only when it is applied to the total stabilized net income from both the business and the real estate. So what the city is saying they're doing is they're starting with the income to the total assets, but they're deducting the business value and deducting the FF&E, so they end up with the income to just the real estate. And so if they take a cap rate from one of the surveys, which is where they cite their source for their cap rate, which is a cap rate for the total assets, the cap rate that they should be applying to just the real estate of the hotel would be lower. And that's correct. If they had removed the business value and the tangible property properly. But what they've done to remove, as they say, the business value is to deduct a management fee and a franchise fee. And this removes nothing from the nothing of the business from the real estate. These are simply the costs of those assets. And as I said in the first webinar, that would be like just giving the lender back the $100,000 loan and not paying him any interest. All you're doing there is identifying the return of the investment, and you're ignoring the return on it. And I'm going to quote another source, the California State Board of Equalization Assessor's Handbook, which says the following. The value of intangible assets and rights cannot be removed by merely deducting the related expenses from the income stream to be capitalized. Allowing a deduction for the associated expense does not allow for a return on the capital expenditure. So back to what DC does and what it does not do correctly. They don't deduct any intangible value. They simply deduct the cost of the franchise. And so the residual income that they are left with is income to the real estate and business. And that cannot be capitalized with a real estate cap rate, which is what they do. Now let's take a look at what they've done with the taking out the tangible personal property. They get close to doing this correctly. And as I described in the seminar that they attended and I gave for the Board of Appeals, the way that you do this is you get the value of the tangible personal property and you multiply it by a tangible personal property cap rate. And that rate would be higher typically than a real estate cap rate. But problem with what they've done is that there is no support for the rate that they use to multiply times the value of the tangible personal property and thus get the income. And when you look at that rate closely, it is clearly not the appropriate rate to allow them to do that. So the bottom line is, Jeremy, what they do here is they start with the actual income, which may or may not be appropriate. I mean, if the hotel isn't operating at market, that income wouldn't necessarily be appropriate. They then don't deduct anything for the business because all they take is the franchise and management fees, and those are just expenses of operating the business. They aren't the return on the business. And then they incorrectly remove the tangible personal property, and so what you end up with is an assessment that's based on more than just the real property of the hotel.
Okay. Well, thank you, David. That's what I expected you to say. You and I met at a board hearing last year and presented this to the board and faced some challenges when the decision came, and it was kind of clear that they didn't quite understand it, and they didn't quite understand hotel valuations, which is really why it's so important to understand the appeal process. And unfortunately for some folks, the court process is quite confusing, but that's why folks like Ralph and Matt are available. And in part two and part three of this, I'm going to discuss more on part one and two of the appeal process, the first level and second level, and then Matt Wright from Aaron Fox will take over and really explain the very complex court process to go through in order to it's going to end up getting a lot of these cases settled. So thanks again for listening, and hopefully we were able to help you along the way on this, and I look forward to speaking some more in part three. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
I think that's good. Awesome. In the interest of time, I'll kick it off with the usual intro for podcast number three, if that works.
Hold on, Ralph. Let me just pull up one document I want to refer to, and I don't want to be clicking while we're
Ralph, how do you think that sounded?
I think it was good. There's a lot coming at you at one time.
Right. That's right.
And
in fact, one of the things I wanted to ask was, who do we think the target audience for this is going to be in terms of their knowledge of hotel valuation? I would expect they would know the fundamentals and just be a little confused or hazy about the detail.
I think that depends on the size of the hotel. The person is probably the general manager and isn't going to understand it at all. For a larger hotel, our audience is probably either the owner's rep or property manager, the hotel manager.
And they would?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
In some general sense.
Okay, sorry.
Well, I think we've sort of got cramming into, 20 minutes. I think we have to get in the information, and it does create a little bit of a problem, but let's see how it sounds when we hear it back.
I
didn't want to interrupt because I didn't know how much more detail we were going to get in. I think it was a little confusing about the different cap rates, the real estate cap rate, and the tangible property cap rate. I think you made it clearer at the end. I was toying with interrupting earlier, but didn't want to upset the flow.
Okay.
All right,
hey,
well,
Ralph,
yeah, I'm ready.
Quick.
We can go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Jeremy. Didn't mean to cut you off.
I was just going to say I'm ready to jump into this, but we And if we need to re-record two, we can post one. And then if we need to re-record two, then David and I and, well, I guess, Ralph, we need you for the introduction. David and I can go ahead and just take that out, knock that out at some point.
Yeah, I think it was very good. And I'm just not sure. I'm trying to listen and trying to listen as someone who doesn't know maybe as much as I do. I understood it. But I think, as David knows, and trying to educate me over the years, it's not something that everybody's going to grasp in the first pass.
Right.
Maybe what we should do is have a couple of the like tax people here, like maybe Ross or maybe Sue, listen to it because they really haven't focused on this topic as we have, and get a sort of a candid feedback from them on what they think.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I think that's a good idea. I think also, speaking somewhat selfishly on this on behalf of both of us, the message that comes through is it's complicated.
Right,
right.
And
well, you know,
that's
the
real thing. Yeah, and it is the case. And you all have explained it pretty well. And if they're still not, it's almost a teaser to invite them to contact you to ask for more information. And that's what we want. We want to use this webinar as a catalyst to potential clients reaching out to both of us.
Yeah,
that's
I was thinking the same
point.
Thing. You want them to get in here and understand. I mean, we can do – David teaches, what, a week-long course on just one of these topics. And
right.
the people walk out of there saying, I don't get it. So we're not going to be able to cram this all in no matter how we do it. But if we cram it in to say, okay, I get some of it, but these guys clearly know more on it than I do, then maybe I shouldn't go at this myself.
That's
yeah,
exactly
I mean, that's
right.
why the thing about the franchise where some of them might go, well, I thought that removed the business value.
Mm-hmm.
And just to hear that it doesn't. And then what I tried to emphasize is that the bottom line is they're not doing it correctly and they're ending up taxing more than they should. And if they get that message, coupled with the fact that they don't really understand why, then maybe they will seek us out to learn more.
Right.
Right.
I think it was good. I do think it was good. And so, you know, we ought to listen to all these sessions again. But it's a lot of information being thrown at you. But you listen a second time. And as they have the option of doing, and I think it's going to be clear. But if not, as you say, we can re-record.
One thought, Jeremy mentioned in reference to the prior calendar podcast that he did, that there was a document that actually, charted what the critical dates were on the calendar, and that could be a reference just as sort of an adjacent PDF link next to the URL link to the podcast. If
right.
there's a way to distill the comparison between how DC values hotels and how David suggests hotels should be valued, the five or six or seven different triggers, the inflection points on valuation in a side-by-side document, either a one-page or a two-page PDF, that is something that a listener can also visually pick up and read along with. It sort of anchors them as you go through each of those points. I think that might be useful.
We could put on the blog page other resources, something very short, whether you have to re-record or not, and I'm not sure you will, that just explains these concepts without giving away everything, which is what Matt is suggesting.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you could take...
If you look at the assessor's work papers, it's not laid out there easily.
No.
It's still pretty complex. And there
and
are
we don't want
out.
Our clients to be looking at the assessor's work pages. We want you to be doing that.
Right. And by going through and looking at the assessor's work, we would have to pull that out in order to... I think what Matt's suggesting is a great idea if we truly wanted to, I guess, kind of give away the secrets here, the trade secrets. I think the goal is to get them interested, slightly confused, and also informed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could put something together on that sense. I mean, the calendar.
Yeah, I mean,
more...
I kind of agree with that, Jeremy. I mean, if I was thinking after Matt said that if I took like the page of the stabilized income, how they go in through the calculation, you know, I could circle like and have a line over to the right, the income, and say, you know, actual income, is it the correct income? That would depend on such and such. Then I could circle the deduction for management and franchise, and you could say, but this doesn't remove anything.
Right.
This is just an expense, and then you could go down to the cap rates. But the problem with that is it does give away the secrets.
Right.
It really does. You know, David, in most of your appraisal reports that I've seen over the years, you have a one-page graph or chart that defines the problem of hotel real property assessment. And I can picture it had circles of FF&E,
right,
and then intangibles and whatever, and it mentioned in later versions return on and return of.
Right,
each.
I have two charts that I used, yeah.
Yeah, and that is widely enough used that, you know, I think you wouldn't be giving away too much because it doesn't tell you where you get the numbers from. It just tells you the concept.
Right, I agree. Those I could certainly make available quickly. I have those done.
One other thing, and I think we do have the listener recording on this, but I confess I was jotting down something. I got confused at the very beginning on the tax year, calendar year, income and expense statement issue. We're in tax year. We're in the appraisal date or the assessment date for 2016 is January 1, 2015.
Right.
The income, which calendar year, are we looking at calendar year 2014?
We are, but they're looking at 13.
Ah, and that's because
the
calendar year 14 doesn't come out until March of 2015.
And until April 2015, and they've already determined their values.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the confusion there, I guess. And that's why I wanted to bring it up. And we discussed that that calendar leave behind thing that we talked about.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what that is. That's what that's about.
Okay. Yeah, I think that you referred to this other seminar, and I presume that it was clear in that.
We did a webinar topic strictly on that.
So when they come out with the assessed value in 20, the point is when they come out with an assessed value in January 1, they're looking at data for calendar year 2013.
Correct.
Even though 3 months later, 4 months later, they'll have the calendar year 2014 I&E statement.
Right, and they've been talking for 2 years now that they want to push the date where you get your notice from March 1st to July 1st,
mm-hmm,
so they can utilize that information. There are 50 problems with that, but one of them is it's the theory that they're going to be able to get the information in the door April 15th, which they're thinking about changing until March 15th,
mm-hmm,
get that information in the door March 15th, and then turn it around to a value in 2 months, which is just not, knowing that office, there's no possible way they could do that.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point for the appeal process, is that they recognize that they really ought to be using more current data. And in some instances, if the data is better for you when you get the calendar year 14 information, you would want to appeal because you have a better chance of getting having success.
Right. Right,
okay.
Exactly. Yeah, so in part three, I'm just going to very briefly glance over sections one and two. I mean, 5 minutes at the most, level one and level two, and then really just hand it to Matt, but also beyond if any questions pop up or if Matt wants to engage in any kind of how does OTR see it side that him and I discussed.
Yeah, I think when I get into the mediation piece, Jeremy, I think that's a perfect point, you know, because you've been on the opposite side of the table at many of these mediations. You know, how the Office of Attorney General and OTR prepares for, and you know, your perspective in those participations. What do you see as OTR's role? How seriously do they take it? You know, what's the likelihood of getting cases resolved at mediation if both sides are really prepared to discuss the details?
Right.
But particularly how OTR prepares or doesn't.
Right. I mean, Yeah, they take a stab at it at least.
They do.
Which is more we could say about a lot of things.
Right. Okay.
Perfect. So, Ralph, real quick, this is Matt. I'll do my usual intro, and then at the end, mm-hmm. did you want to just do a wrap-up and say, and that concludes our three-part series, blah, 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 and then we can just end it there? And then let's all stay on the line, because I know Emily wanted to jump on. She's listening in to just discuss logistics and all that kind of stuff for about 2 minutes,
good.
And then we all can move on with our days.
Perfect.
Awesome. All right, so here we go, number three. Welcome back to our unique co-podcast with Altus State and Local Tax and Advisory and the law firm of Arent Fox. Today you're going to hear part three of this interview series with Arent Fox and Altus Group, once again about hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. And once again, we're going to hand it over to our moderator, Ralph Taylor, who's a partner with the law firm of Arent Fox. Take it away, Ralph.
Thank you, Matt. Welcome to our third and final segment of our webinar on what you need to know about hotel real property taxation in the District of Columbia. My name is Ralph Taylor, and I'm a partner in the D.C. law firm of Arent Fox, and I am the moderator of all three sessions. To recap, in part one, David Lenhoff provided an introduction to tax valuation of real property in general, followed by a more specific discussion of hotel valuations and why such valuations are different from valuations of other properties. In part two, Jeremy Chetlick and David discuss more specifically how D.C. assesses the value of hotels and identified issues that may unduly increase your assessment and the tax bill based on it. This final session will provide a description of how you can appeal your hotel assessment if you think it is too high, and it will also discuss the costs and benefits of appealing. Our speakers today are Jeremy Chetlick and Matt Wright. As you know, Jeremy is a tax consultant who helps taxpayers minimize their real property taxes and mitigate the impact of real property assessments. As part of his services, Jeremy assists clients in first and second level administrative appeals of real property tax assessments. Matt Wright is an experienced trial lawyer and a partner in the litigation department of Arent Fox, where he practices in the area of complex commercial, real estate, and D.C. real estate tax litigation. Matt has years of experience as litigation counsel for property owners appealing real property tax assessments in the District of Columbia, especially owners of hard-to-value properties like hotels, nursing homes, and subsidized housing complexes that present unique and challenging taxation and assessment issues. More complete bios of Jeremy and Matt, along with those of David Lenhoff and myself, are posted on the Altus blog site. Jeremy, could you kick us off for this third session?
Sure. Thanks. Appreciate it, Ralph. So D.C., like most places around the country, but almost exclusively all places in the jurisdictions in the Mid-Atlantic, run a three-tier system. So your first level, you meet with the assessor, which I'll discuss. Second level, you meet with an appeals board, the Real Property Tax Assessment Commission. And then the third level, you go to actual court, which Matt is the expert on, and he'll talk about that. So the first level is just an informal discussion with the assessor. D.C. provides two pretty critical pieces of information that you should try to get immediately, which is your assessor worksheet. That worksheet is what is used to value the property. It's really all the calculations that go into how your assessment came to the value that it is. The second is called a pertinent data book, and this is supposed to be at least all the information used by the assessor to value properties in the district. Both documents are critical to a successful appeal, not just the first level, but having that all the way through the appeal process is important. So the most important thing with the first level is providing solid and supportable information to the assessor. This allows them to make a decision. If you don't give the assessor anything, they're not going to change anything. They need to justify the change to their supervisors. They need to say, this is why I valued it this, and now this is why I think it's less. And without any information, they're not going to make a change. And that's more, again, that's something that's consistent all the way through the process as well. But by getting that to them early, it allows for an early change. So,
Jeremy, is there a timeline or deadline for submitting that information to the assessor?
The appeal deadline is April 1st. With the appeal deadline, you need to file two pieces of paper, a appeal form and a letter of authorization if you're not the owner. If you're the owner, you just need to submit that appeal form. The information you need to submit, it's best to submit it by your hearing when you actually come in. In some cases, the assessor will suggest, hey, if you really want this done, I need the following five things within the next 2 weeks. Really, you need to get this information to them by no later than August 1st, because that's oftentimes when they're required to have all their decisions done. So mid-July is really the best. Really the best way to do it is to bring it in with you for your hearing. If there's a situation where you have something like you say a building's falling apart and they say it's excellent, it's best just to say, meet me at the property. If you get to an assessor early, in mid-April, early May, they're often willing to just meet you at the property and get this hammered out. But scheduling can be really tricky if you're representing yourself. You'll get a notice with a specific time, say, be here on this date at this time, either late May, usually late May, early June for the commercial properties. For the reps like myself, they'll say, come in here the week of June 20th and be here the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and sit in a room and tell us who you need, and if they're here, come in. If not, have somebody else and just kind of spend some time in the office. It's actually a very effective way to do things. They do a great job scheduling those. It's much better than saying, come in here at 9, have a case, then be back at 4:30 and have another case and do that over a long period of time. So they're very accommodating with that. They do a very good job. It's best to reach out to your assessor and try to prearrange a time to meet instead of just hoping a notice shows up at your door. A lot of times, especially for the reps, if you just wait for a notice, you might not get one. You might go to a P.O. box or the property address or your old address, and if you never see it, you just missed your first level. That first level is very informal, but if it managed correctly, it can be very, very productive. The second level, I call it the Real Property Tax Assessment Commission. It's actually the Real Property Tax Appeals Commission. In order to file there, you have an appeal form, which is includes much more information. You have to provide 3 years of NOI, 3 years of expenses, a couple questions about the property. It requires 2 years of income and a separate LOA, their specific LOA. You sit on one side, the assessor sits on the other side, and then a three-person panel of real estate experts or real estate professionals with some type of real estate backgrounds hear both sides of the case and ask questions. You present, the assessor presents, you rebut, the assessor rebuts, they ask some questions. They're required by law to send a decision by February 1st in order to get the potential reduction in the system prior to paying the tax bill. Historically, they haven't gotten to that deadline. I believe the last few years, once they've become more of a professional board and new leadership, they've hit that deadline of February 1st, and it really hasn't been any type of issue. If you're totally unhappy, you find plain error in the decision, something else comes out, maybe they provided some information in their response that neither side presented, they often will grant a rehearing where you can go in and try one more time. These hearings can be really hit or miss, and a lot of it depends on who's sitting on that panel, which board member you're getting that day, and which assessor is assigned to your property. It's a much, much more formal process than the first level. It's not a trial in any sense, but it's nice to dress up and look nice and be very prepared going into that, much less than kind of a sit back and have a decision with the assessor. It's more of, like I said, a formal process.
It's really Jeremy, speaking of,
yeah,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
And the predecessor was BRPA, the Board of Real Property Assessment and Appeals. It was common, although you had a three-member panel requirement, that often you only had two people actually showing up on the panel. Is that still happening with REPTAC?
No. REPTAC really tries to get a three-member panel. I have not had a situation where only a two-member panel. Now, for the residential cases, my understanding is that they can have as few as one member on just a single-member panel. But for the commercial cases, my understanding is they always have three. There's a big difference between this and the previous board. The previous board was part-time employees. It wasn't run quite as well, and the reason they had two-member panels because that day maybe only two people would show up.
Right.
This board has full-time employees. It also has some part-times, but they run two panels at a time, three panels, in some cases they'll have three, but in most cases for commercial cases they'll have two panels, three people each panel, and you don't really have to deal with the two-member issue.
Great.
So the third step here is the court step, which Matt can walk you through as he's experienced in that topic. And although the formal level from first level to second level kind of increases slightly, it really gets going for that third level. So I'll let Matt take over on that.
Thanks, Jeremy. So if a hotel owner remains dissatisfied with the result of its administrative appeals, it has one final recourse, and that is to the Superior Court Tax Division. So a judicial appeal is basically a lawsuit. It's a lawsuit against the district to challenge the assessment in court. The appeal is heard by a tax court judge de novo, and that means that the judge is not bound by OTR's assessment or any administrative adjustment at either the assessor or commission level. You basically start at the beginning, and the petitioner bears the burden of proof to persuade the court that the original assessment was an error and it should be reduced, and why. So the first question is, when can you file a judicial appeal? There are a couple of predicates or what are called jurisdictional requirements before a judicial appeal can be filed. The first is to go through the administrative appeal process the way Jeremy described it. You have to exhaust both your first level and second level administrative appeal, and you need to do that in a timely fashion. That's required by the statute. The next requirement is that you have to have paid all of your taxes in advance prior to filing a judicial appeal. That's another statutory requirement. The third requirement is that the petition has to be filed with the court no later than September 30th in the calendar year in which you're challenging the assessment. So if you're considering a judicial appeal of a tax assessment in the district this year, you would need to have already exhausted your administrative appeals, paid your taxes in September, and get a petition on file with the tax division no later than September 30th.
That is for tax year 2015.
That's right. And failure to satisfy each of those requirements could pose a bar to any further appeal. And so you would not be allowed to raise a judicial appeal in court for tax year 2015 if you miss any of those triggers. There are lots of situations where a judicial appeal might make sense. In the first two sessions of this podcast series, David and Jeremy have gone into a lot of detail about ways that there are potentially calculation errors in how your hotel property is assessed, potentially improperly. Wrong capitalization rates, wrong income and expense information, failure to take into account substantial capital improvements, lots of things that were addressed in the first two segments. Another issue is equalization. The district is required to tax comparable levels comparably. That's the notion of equalization. No hotel owner wants to pay more than its fair share of property taxes, especially if hotels in your competitive set seem to be paying less. Assessments are public. They're published on the OTR database, so it's fairly easy to know what other hotels are paying in terms of taxes and to see where your tax assessment fits. If you feel as though you are out of equalization, if you feel that your tax assessment is higher than the hotel properties in your competitive set, that's frequently a very powerful argument. It's persuasive both to the Office of Attorney General, who represents the district, when you're negotiating a potential mediation or settlement of these cases. It's certainly a very powerful argument to judges when they're weighing and considering judicial appeals. But, from the beginning, at the outset of making a decision whether to pull the trigger on a judicial appeal, it's wise for a hotel owner to sit down and really run a cost-benefit analysis, weighing the anticipated cost of litigation against the potential refund it might obtain if it's successful. Hotel properties present a really interesting opportunity to pursue a judicial appeal, mostly because the tax rate for hotels is so high in the district. It's 1.85%, which is a lot higher than standard commercial properties. Hotel properties are also generally highly valued properties, so you're talking about assessments that are pretty large. So the possibility of obtaining a substantial refund, especially if you apprehend that you're out of equalization or that there are real errors in the way your hotel property was valued, can present a real opportunity for the numbers to pencil out in a hotel owner's favor. I want to talk a little bit about what the judicial appeal process looks like. it runs a fairly standard sort of calendar and process. The petitions are generally filed in late September. The district has 60 days to file its answer to a taxpayer's petition. After that, the court schedules what's called a mandatory initial mediation date. No discovery, no real litigation is allowed until that initial mediation takes place. And that mandatory mediation feature of tax appeals is really important, and it distinguishes these cases from the ordinary civil cases that you may be familiar with. So every single case, before anything really happens other than the filing of the petition, it's scheduled for mediation at the court's multi-door dispute resolution center. And this was implemented many years ago for docket control purposes. There are, as you might imagine, thousands of real estate tax appeals every year. And the courts wanted to build in an automatic mechanism to try and resolve these cases early before the parties and the courts devote substantial resources to the litigation process. So this initial mediation, I want to talk a little bit more about that because that presents a really useful and unique opportunity to resolve these cases very early on at the process in a real cost-advantageous manner. 60 days prior to the scheduled mediation date, the petitioner submits a mediation statement that presents its proposal for how it thinks the case might be resolved. And this submission can be as basic or as comprehensive as you want it to be, but most practitioners, myself included, will certainly advise you that it pays to be very prepared for that mediation because OAG and OTR take that process pretty seriously, and they're generally prepared to discuss the merits of the case and frequently have advanced authority to negotiate. And the more specific you can be about particular errors in the valuation in the assessment, or if you've determined that the hotel is out of equalization with competitive hotel properties, the better poised you are to potentially resolve the case at that initial mediation before you expend significant resources in discovery and further litigation. Jeremy, you worked at OTR for many years. You've been on the opposite side of the table from property owners. What's your analysis or view of that initial mediation process?
It's very important. OTR takes it serious. They do a good job of preparing for it. They often come to the table if you provided something realistic. I mean, if the assessment's $100 million and you're coming in saying it's worth $50 and I'm not going to settle anything for less than $50, then you're just going through the motions. But if it's $100 and you think it's worth $50, but you come in and say, here's where we're apart, here are the differences, here's where we can maybe meet in the middle, get close, then they often will work with you. It's not unrealistic or unheard of to think that they will make a huge reduction at mediation. The one thing to know is that there is a lot of cases in the trial track. The last I heard was pushing 2,000. So although your property is very unique to you and very important to you, to OTR is just another case. So for them, you might spend 25 hours for mediation. They might spend two. And that's just kind of the harsh reality of it. So they aren't going to really dig as deep as you are, but that doesn't mean they're not authorized and they're not prepared and they don't do a good job.
Yeah, and I would say just to kind of close the loop on that, I mean, you know, my experience has generally been that the OTR representatives and the Office of Attorney General representatives, they're generally motivated to get to the right and a fair result. They are not as automatically positional as private litigants are in the other kinds of civil litigation that I'm normally involved in. So, a reasonably high percentage of these cases can be resolved out of the box at mediation, but not all of them do end up getting resolved at mediation. So if the case proceeds, if you can't get to yes at the initial mediation, a pretrial calendar is set. Fact discovery begins. Fact discovery in these kinds of cases is not as scary and not as expensive as, again, other civil litigation matters that you may have experience in. It's usually very fact-specific to your property, potentially to properties in your competitive set, but it doesn't involve a lot of fact witness depositions. What it really essentially boils down to is, ultimately a battle of the experts. Putting an appraisal report, in front of the district or ultimately the court that is very persuasive, that ultimately presents an opinion and an explanation of value that will carry the day. And so the next major inflection point for settlement is frequently after fact discovery is concluded and the parties exchange expert reports. You know, frequently that gives each side food for thought, and you can often schedule either a private mediation or simply pick up the phone and call OAG and try to work something out that way. If the case still can't resolve, then the case is set for a trial calendar, and the case proceeds before a tax court judge. And again, the plaintiff has the burden of proof in order to prevail. There are, you know, costs, as you might imagine, there are costs and benefits to consider when weighing a tax appeal. A $1 million reduction in assessment roughly equates to an $18,500 refund. A $10 million reduction in assessment is $185,000. So if you're a hotel property with a valuation north of $50 or $75 million, if you think that you can get a $10 or $20 million reduction, if you've got principled reasons to get there, you can be talking about real money. And it's also important to think of the knock-on consequences of planting the flag and appealing an assessment if you think it really is an overassessment or out of equalization. Because if you are able to either get a negotiated reduction or an adjudicated reduction, you know, that reduction, the effects of that echo potentially in future years, because it will be more difficult for the district to substantially move off of an adjudicated reduction, you know, for example, in the next calendar year. The risks of appeal or costs of appeal, obviously there are attorney's fees and discovery costs and the costs of an expert report and expert testimony. Those are generally the costs that you think of when you think of appealing a tax appeal in superior court. There is certainly uncertainty in any trial de novo. There are no guarantees in litigation. It's a human instrument, and although rare, you know, a court actually has the power to even increase an assessment at trial. So that's something that every potential litigant should be aware of. That being said, though, you know, attorney's fees vary from case to case. The intensity of discovery varies from case to case. But the costs of this type of litigation is generally quite a bit less than other types of ordinary commercial litigation that you'd see in civil court. The costs of the first appeal are also generally higher than subsequent appeals. That's for a couple of different reasons. You know, there are learning curves associated with the unique facts and circumstances of learning about and diving deeply into a specific hotel property. But there are often economies of scale when you're representing a property owner over multiple tax appeals or years. And because of the number of appeals and the sort of inherent delays in the tax calendar, it is not at all uncommon for a tax case, let's say tax year 2014, just had its initial mediation. It's gone through some fact discovery. It's now time to file another appeal for tax year 15. You can frequently join or what's called consolidate tax appeals, and so you're effectively litigating two appeal years together. And that, again, presents another potential cost saving for a litigant because you've got the economy of scale only having to pay to litigate two appeals once. Some final thoughts. In prior tax year appeal cycles, especially in the period around 2008 to 2011, there were a lot of macroeconomic disruptions in the market that really affected hotel and investment property values. Those have really since normalized. Those macroeconomic arguments, you know, are less available now than they were previously. So that makes it even more important to have a really experienced advocate and an expert consultant that really understands hotels and hotels specifically when you're pursuing a judicial appeal. Each property is different. There may be issues of functional obsolescence or a transition to a new flag or out of the ordinary capital expenses that, you know, may be unique to a property but may be very important in how it's valued. And understanding those issues and being able to present those and articulate those clearly, both at mediation and at trial, are very important. It's important to know also that a petitioner controls the process. You know, filing a judicial appeal does not commit you to litigating the case through trial. You know, a petitioner controls how far the process will go. It may decide to settle. It may decide to withdraw a case prior to trial if priorities or objectives change. So once you file a petition, it is not irrevocable. and it doesn't commit you to spend through a trial if that's not something that you're inclined to do. And finally, I'd just say that, like other civil suits, a majority of judicial appeals are certainly resolved through settlement, through negotiation. But the best leverage to negotiate a good settlement is often experienced counsel who the district knows can and will go the distance and try the case to a court if necessary.
Matt, Ralph, one question. A lot of people are worried about jury trials and the uncertainties and unpredictability of juries. Are these tax cases jury trials?
They are not. They are bench trials. So they're all tried by tax court judges who have specific responsibility for hearing only these kinds of cases.
And follow-up question, slightly unrelated. What if you win, either by settlement or by trial, do you get any interest?
You do, and that's actually another important, you know, sort of factor here when you're weighing the cost benefit. There's a 6% annual interest that's baked into the code. So if you file your appeal, let's say September 30th, 2015, you file a judicial appeal of tax year 2015's assessment, it may take a year or more to ultimately negotiate a settlement that is mutually agreeable or you try the case. Whenever a final judgment is entered, either as a result of settlement or trial, let's say it's entered September 30th, 2016, you'd get 6% interest on the refund calculated from the date you filed your petition, so you'd get 6% annual interest. And frequently, it may take a year and a half, so you're looking at more than 6% interest, over the course of a single appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes the third and final part of our webinar. If you missed either of the first two sessions, you can access them through the Altus blog site, where some additional materials will also be posted. We hope very much that this webinar has been useful to you. If you have any questions or any comments, please contact any one of our participants. Thanks very much.
Perfect. That's a wrap.
Okay.
Great. Good. Thanks.
Thanks very much,
guys.
I thought that worked out really well.
Yeah.
I thought so, too. So I know Emily wants to jump in, but real quick before she speaks up on some of the logistics, what I will do is I will send you a link to this entire recording, which will include everything, all of our discussions in between. You all can check it out, particularly podcast number 2. And then once I get the thumbs up from everybody, I'll send it to my tech guy to start editing it. But in the meantime, I wanted to send you guys the rough link. And then, Emily, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. That was the number one thing I wanted to mention. So we'll have a couple of folks on our end listen to everything. As long as everyone is good to go with the first recording, that was just David and Ralph, we still plan on getting that up on Tuesday. Any thoughts on that?
Sounds good.
Good. Okay. All right, great. So, Matt, when do you need to get feedback for the recordings 2 and 3?
Let's see, because we're staggering these out once each week, and it doesn't really take Mike that much time to edit these up, usually like an hour or two. So, even if we get it, the feedback end of this week, or actually early next, any time next week, we should be fine. And then Emily, per the usual, we'll create the wrapper post, the couple paragraph
yep.
intro to go with it, like we normally do. So what I'll do is I'll have Mike proceed with editing out podcast number 1 for
okay.
us, and then. But like I said, I'll send everybody the link to this entire recording, and then everybody can check it out. But I think overall, it was really really good. I think we have some good stuff here.
Great, and then you'll send the blog post over, we can all just take a look at it, make sure it's got proper contact information and attachments, those kinds of things.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Great. And then I will work with Ashley and Elizabeth over at Iron Fox to figure out where you guys are going to post it, and then we'll get email blasts. And, yeah, like Matt, like you said, it'll be July 21st, 28th, and August 4th to get these three out.
And will we get to see the text of the email blasts before they go out?
Yes.
Good.
All right, great.
Awesome.
That's all I needed. Any questions from anyone or final thoughts?
I don't think so. None from me.
Nope.
So when should we be looking for the unedited recording?
I should have that to you all in probably about 15, 20 minutes. Just take
about good.
10 minutes
okay,
to
well,
render, and I'll just send you the link. Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent.
Great. And awesome. We'll get back to you, I would presume, by the end of the day.
Perfect. That sounds great.
Great.
Okay.
Well,
easy
thank
for me
you,
to
everyone.
Say, how about the people who really were involved?
I think we'll shoot for the end of this week.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, yeah, thanks everyone.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.